Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 15th, 2019, and welcome to episode 205 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever...
GameStar is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and companies, brands, and so forth. So I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by two other vertices on this retro computing triangular table. Joining us from Stockholm, Sweden, is Jack Nutting. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. I've got the tail end of a cold that's dragged on for weeks, but I'm pretty good. So can't complain. Having fun.
All right. And also joining us from Toronto, Canada, is Carrington Matson. How are you?
I am doing well. Outside is cold. I will point at it. For those listening at home, I am pointing out a window.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, actually, winter ended for us. So now there's no more snow. That's all right.
There's a bit of snow, not too much. It's too cold to snow at the moment. So there's that.
That's always pleasing.
Yeah, we had snow here in Stockholm for about a day, and then it melted away. So now Stockholm has reverted to its typical winter, which is just sort of like wet, gray, and a light bit of gravel everywhere. Because there was enough snow for them to put gravel on all the sidewalks and roads, and then that stays there all winter long.
Oh, so you guys still have gravel instead of like salt or something like that?
Yes. So it's gravel everywhere. So it's cool. It's better for the cars and stuff. Probably, but
we still salt here,
too, I guess.
And it's not good for the cars, or I suspect anything else. But we still do it.
Yeah. My treads on my shoes are perfectly, you know, salt sized. So in the winter, all surfaces I walk, like my office floor and stuff, are like littered in little rocks because they come in.
Nice.
Okay. Anyway, so I'm the host today, I guess, and the host's topic today that we came up with is brands for which you have nostalgia, or something like that. So the idea is essentially that as we sort of look through eBay listings and things like that, or just think about things in the past, there are certain companies that tend to just as a whole evoke a kind of a reaction. And I think that came up when we were talking about TG products. You know, they made they made game controllers, and there was something that I saw at an eBay auction, and I pointed out, you know, this the reason. Like, never had the thing. I don't know if I need the thing, but I like the company. So I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about that, if whatever ideas come to mind. So I don't know. Maybe Carrington, you want to start? You had some ideas,
yep,
I think.
Certainly. One of the ones that came to mind for me immediately, which I think we touched on briefly when we were discussing the topic in the last episode or the episode before, whatever, was newer technology, newer tech. I had a couple of their devices. They were sort of, at least I know them as somebody who made Macintosh peripherals in the era when things were like a dark gray. So a lot of the Duo era, they made docks and SCSI dongles and Ethernet port adapters, and they were all amazing, and they looked great, and they felt good, and they just worked, and I just loved them. So I was just right on board. I owned one or two of their things, and for some reason, anytime I see any of their things come up on eBay, I have like a warm glow, like I'm somehow invested in this company. Like, I don't know why somehow I bought into their success, but I was fully on board the newer tech train. Other ones that came to mind were a word processor that I owned, never used, And yet some part of me thinks it's like the greatest thing ever, although I never used it, which is Nisus Writer. So Nisus,
oh, yeah.
N-I-S-U-S, the people who used it and loved it, like loved it. And for some reason, I guess I got too near them in an elevator or something and it spilled over to me and I became a big Nisus cheerleader for a piece of software I never used, like ever. I bought it. I probably bought it a couple times and like, you know, but just never used the thing. But I had this, it was like the first piece of software, first word processor I ever had that you could do really fancy searching. Like, you know, show me all, I don't want to search just like for the word Bob. Show me everywhere the word Bob appears that's underlined and followed by at least two spaces and it can highlight them all at once. Like that kind of stuff. And I was just so impressed by that kind of search, which is commonplace now, but wasn't available to anything else. So I thought, this is amazing. Right. What a great word processor. He said closing it and never using it again. And yet for some reason, I have it in me that it's like the best word processor ever. I totally love it. Maybe because I never used it. But I have a crazy soft spot for Nisus as a company. I think Neurotech and Nisus both still exist, which is amazing. So go them. Yay, team, apparently. when it came to floppy disks, a lot of us had like brand preference, and one that jumped out for me was Elephant. Elephant was always my brand of preference, I guess, because Elephant Never Forgets was a great slogan. I liked their logo, so I was always an Elephant guy. But then there was Dyson disks in that purpley kind of box, I guess, wine colored, like a mauve. And for some reason, I thought that was the best disc. I think because they were really expensive or something. So I almost never used them, but I have a weird soft spot for both Elephant and Dyson. Elephant because of nostalgia, Dyson because I somehow bought into that they're better than what I'm buying, but I can't afford them. So I get on board with brands somehow, like hardcore, and I don't even understand it. I feel like this is a safe space and I can share all this with you guys. Another one that came up, which I think you mentioned in the notes already, Paul, was Ambrosia software maker. I think of them as a game maker, but they made other things too. Again, for early Macintosh stuff, although they did make the transition over to the at least 68K, if not OS 10 stuff. I think maybe OS 10 as well. But I knew them as a classic Mac game maker. Everybody loves the Escape Velocity stuff, the EV things. I never played those games, and they were their biggest games. But for me, it was stuff like Maelstrom and Swoop, which were asteroids and like Galaxian clones, and a thing called Fresnel's Wand. With an F. I like that game. But there was Harry the Handsome Executive. Great name, great game. I adored that thing. It was amazing. You had to move around in the chair. It was a top-down thing, and you'd have to
you push
backwards. You had to go backwards, and you can get like pop cans out of machines and throw them at enemies. It was amazing. I loved that thing. But it overall, though, it was like I had this soft spot for Ambrosia. Whether I would have the game or not, even if it was a game I thought was only okay, for some reason, I always was rooting for them as a software developer. Like something about it just had this warm and fuzzy glow. So that's software stuff. And then when it comes to printed material, there was a long period where I was like hardcore drink the Kool-Aid Mac fan. A lot of Apple II people were not, like with what, you know, how what Apple dealt with the Apple II. A lot of people did not follow into the Macintosh world, but I did. I saw my first Mac, I was just right on board. Apple's dead, Mac is the future. I don't know. I'm a person of extremes. And so during the Guy Kawasaki days, the whole them versus us stuff, which is a thing I do now, ironically. At least I think ironically, it's sometimes hard to tell with me, but like I'm pretty sure I do this ironically. I was seriously on board with just like the Macintosh brand in general, but the kind of magazines like Mac Addict in particular that were rah-rah, go Mac, we're amazing, freaking awesome. I just bought into that for a small period. So when it comes to magazines, like just the Mac Addict logo, I'm drawn to it. I think it's amazing. It had that kind of edgy-ish for a young person kind of feel to it. I loved it. So I think Mac
like a
Week,
punk underdog.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of punk in an Avril Lavigne sort of way. Like that kind of punk. Mac Week was another one that I loved as a magazine because it felt like insider, like, oh, I'm getting Mac Week. I'm like, I'm an industry person, whatever. But it was Mac Addict was like the thing that I'm like kind of drawn to. And so I think those are the things that like came to mind immediately when it comes to like, and then CH products, and I think you were talking about, but like CH joysticks and that kind of stuff, super, super into them, love them. They were the joystick for me. And that's everything that jumped to mind, I think, but I'm sure you guys are going to mention stuff that I'll also go, oh yeah, that one too. So.
Quite possibly.
Cool.
I don't know, Jack, are there any things left?
There are some things left. Actually, it's funny, Karen, when you said floppy disk, the first thing that came to mind to me was Elephant. Like, that mm-hmm. is the brand. That was what you wanted to have in mm-hmm. general. Of course, I had all kinds of stuff, but I remember having
those. But were they actually good? Like, I had them and I loved them, but I have no idea if that was actually, other than liking their logo and liking their slogan, I don't know why I thought they were great and why I was defending them as a good product.
Yeah, I don't know why either. Like, I think that I had so few disc failures in general, at least back in the day. I'm sure all those discs are probably dead by now. If I had them in hand, they probably, most of them wouldn't work. But, you know, I think I didn't have enough, even though I used hundreds of floppies, I don't think I used enough to make a statistically meaningful determination of which brand could be better than another. Just, I don't know. But yes, that popped into mind. Another thing that came to mind for me, though, when it came to like game controllers was Wico. Yeah. Who they made a lot of things, but they didn't make Apple II products much. Maybe they did somewhat, but like they were mostly digital, like, you know, up, down, left, right, on, off joysticks rather than the analog was you had for the Apple II. But so like for the Atari and Commodore and other things, this was what you wanted to have because they were big and sturdy, and it would have like a big big shaft and a big ball. It looked like an arcade.
They were the ones that were always looked really red, right? It was a big red.
Yeah, they had a lot of red. Yeah, red and black was the typical thing. Yeah. And I have a couple of them now. I think I have one that I've had since the 80s, actually. One of a few things that's from my original set of stuff that has followed with me. And then another one that I acquired more recently. And they're still really great. That was one thing for me. Like, I remember back in the day, like, those were always the joysticks that everyone in my circle wanted to have. But they were pretty expensive compared to other ones. So you probably only had one. Few people ever had two.
I bet that's how most of these happen, though, is like your circle or your group. Somebody in it likes a thing, and so therefore we all like it. Like, that's just the nature of being kids.
Yep.
Explains so much of my fashion as a child.
There was that. Another brand that I thought of that I remember that I loved. Well, two brands that I loved back in the 80s were both software companies, Epix and Electronic Arts. Mm-hmm. Like both of these were so much, they had so many games they put out that were so much like my cup of tea between those two things. You had like all the things like these summer games and California games, Archon, and like for me, these two companies that they dominated so much my mind space. I'm not totally sure. I think Electronic Arts put out Archon.
Epix, and
Epix put out things like Summer Games and Mission Impossible and these seemed to me at the time to be the top game companies.
Which is so funny because I had the exact opposite. Like EA, I thought was amazing. I love their big album size things you'd open up and the black and white artsy pictures of the developers. Love them. Love their games. Love them.
Yeah.
But Epix, as a kid, I thought was one of those like low end things. Like, oh, avoid their software. Something to do with their box and their logo looked like, oh, this must be just like knockoff software. Or like, it kind of looked like the packaging for late era Atari 2600 games to me. So I avoided them thinking, well, that must be terrible software. I'm not going to spend all my money on that. That must be terrible.
I remember what Pac-Man was like.
Yeah. I'm not going there again. No, so those were ones for me. And also thought of, the other thing about Epix also is that later they actually came out with a couple of different game controllers. And they were ones where it's kind of like you hold sort of a big block in your hand and has a little joystick on top of it, and it's micro switches. So it was very sort of clicky-clicky sort of thing. And so the clump in your hand is molded to be inner hand-shaped. So it's sort of designed so you can sit and hold this in your left hand for hours and use the little joystick on top. And I still have one of those, too. And it's always been great. It has, like, it's plastic, but then it has an outer covering that is soft plastic, kind of feels like the sole of, a sneaker or something. And it has weirdly aged and yellowed, but it still works and feels the same. It hasn't cracked, it hasn't peeled. It's okay. It's cracked and peeled less than I have, so it's fine. I accept it as it is. Yeah. So those are my things. Oh, the other thing that came to mind for me as like a nostalgia brand that I didn't really have or use in the 80s much at all, but at least not at home, was Epson. Like the printers at school, they were always Epson printers.
I had Epson printers. Yeah.
I don't think I had an Epson printer back in the day. I think the first Epson printer I ever had personally was probably a much more newish inkjet in the past 15, 20 years. But that's just sort of me. That was the sort of solid printer brand that I have in my nostalgia.
I had the exact same experience. I had an Epson either LX80 or FX80, whichever is one that's like pointy, looked like a Fiero, just weird looking printer, but I loved it and it lasted for ages. And yeah, so I have a real soft spot for that thing. In the comments, Richard Thompson says he mentioned applied engineering. That's a great choice. If I had thought of it, I would have mentioned it. That I also have huge soft spot for that brand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. And sort of like Nicesrader, I loved it, but I had nothing at the time from them. I think I thought of them as very high end. But
so what about you, Paul? What do you got?
Well, what's left? I agree about Epson. They always seem like they were the standard printer, like the kind you want. You know, like if anything else, any other kind of printer you got, like whatever Gorilla Banana or whatever, those are the things that they were like
Gorilla Banana
advertised. They're always little knockoffs. I don't know what that is. Is it banana? Is it
a Gorilla Banana? I don't know.
There's some ad that was on like the inside front cover of like every third magazine I got. I mean, they advertised super heavily. You know what I'm talking about?
It sounds a bit familiar. I feel like I recognize this somewhere, but I don't know what it was.
Yeah, it was a printer. I've seen somewhere. Now, see, maybe when we get to the eBay section, I'll see if I can find any banana printers.
Yes, a Gorilla printer.
At any rate, you know, it always seemed like Epson was the kind you wanted and the good kind, and everything else was a knockoff.
Right.
But, so the other thing, with discs, I was actually trying to search for like what the bad ones were. but yeah, I mean, I think 3M was that was always like the disc you wanted for me. I mean, like, you know, I liked Elephant, but 3M was always what I would want to try to get. And I think that choice held up. Not like I would based it on anything other than living in their state. You know, but those are the ones that still, even if you get new in box now, they're good. They never fail. And Nashua discs were crap. I mean, maybe they weren't bad at the time, but boy, did they not hold up. Like, I'm pretty sure that if I have a Control Data disc, Verbatim's not great. Control Data or Nashua disc now, it's likely to not read well. But
I had a lot of Verbatim discs fail back in the day. That became a brand that I would avoid because of that. I got very unlucky with a bunch of them and then just...
Right.
There's lots of brands like that I liked... Mm-hmm. Or thought I would like, and then I turned against. I have like more brands that I was like anti than brands I was pro. Like Cork Express was my whole life, and then I learned to hate them. and then moved over to Adobe and like never liked them, but just was still anti Cork. Like just lots of brands that I was against. It could be on a whole other topic. Just rant.
Yeah. So maybe companies are sort of people.
He said for tax purposes.
Right. Right. But let's see. What was I? Well, there was something I was mid thinking about, and it's gone now. But whatever.
Well, in the show notes, you mentioned Panic, which is such a great choice.
Yeah. So Panic is sort of like Ambrosia, I think, and maybe somewhat contemporaneous. Though I think Panic's a little later. But they are a company that, I mean, I have a lot of their things. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of their things that I do not have, but I like them. I think that they are kind of. They believe themselves to be, and I think correctly, somewhat of like inspired by Beagle Bros, right? Brothers, whatever it is, Bro S. Dot. In that they have the same sort of like whimsical attitude toward things, and they made very well crafted stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So and make,
I mean, and like still make, and I still like them as a brand. That's a brand I'm like back then. I still like now, and I still use. I have multiple Panic things in my dock at the moment.
Uh huh. I think, what do I have there? I have Transmit. That may be the only one that I still have. They had a really nice Usenet.
Turns out,
reader.
I just have Transmit on my dock. By multiple, I meant Transmit. Like, yeah. Scanning with them. I just assumed I'd have more.
Yeah. But I like them. They had a, what was their audio program? Audion. Which has kind of an interesting story to it, too. That it was almost iTunes.
Yep. So close.
Yeah.
Right.
Cassidy and Green one with, SoundJam. Cassidy Green was another brand I liked. They did Glider and, well, SoundJam and Glider. I don't know. I liked them anyway. Probably other things. Yeah.
Numbers get inflated in Carrington's mind.
Yeah.
There's zero and there's many.
Exactly. I count on my fists. Crystal Quest. Ha! That's another one.
Okay. All right.
Oh.
One, two, three, many.
Right. So the speaking of the discs, there was one. There's a brand. I think is probably kind of more of a personal like that I have, but Centec discs, which were
don't know.
They came in many different colors.
I remember floppy discs that came in colored jackets. Was that what they were? Centec?
Yeah, so they would come in red and green and blue. Yeah. I think you could get them either in like assorted packs or a coherent purple, box. So I have red and brown and orange and purple. And these were, like, in my mind, that was also kind of how I thought about, like, my programming discs or whatever. Like, this was on orange 2.
Orange 2 final, really.
Yeah. But I think the reason I had them was because the person that I worked for when I was in junior high and high school was really into them. So I never had, I guess I had a paper route at one point. But otherwise, I never had a real job. I, like, was immediately in eighth grade recruited as cheap programming labor. So I worked in a computer room, like, through all of that time. And so that actually put me in the context of a number of things, like the Epson QX10 I used because, the guy who ran this hotel was into them and they were new and promising tech. And he bought all these multiple colored discs. So, but I like them. I think they do have a kind of a character to them. So.
Mm. And we're talking about color 5 1/4 inch discs, right?
Yeah.
Because the 3.5 inch discs came often in lots of colors, but I remember there was very few of the 5 1/4 that weren't black.
Mm. You could find them. I think Kodak had some, but Centec was the one that was their thing. So I have a pretty strong, but probably lonely attachment to them. Nobody else knows who they are.
How was Centec spelled?
C-E-N-T-E-C-H.
Oh, okay.
I linked to a box that you could buy on Amazon, which doesn't actually show you the discs very well, but it was the only thing that only sort of place I could find even something close to.
And I found the Gorilla Banana printer ad and stuck a link in the show notes for that too, so that'll be for the show. I found a Gorilla Banana printer ad.
But it looks familiar, right?
It does look familiar, after I saw it. I never would have been able to bring that to mind without you mentioning it. And once I saw it, I'm like, oh yeah, I saw this all the time. I guess because I never linked to that brand. Like, I never had one. I didn't know anybody with one. So I just, got ad blindness for it.
Right.
It's funny, though. I wonder what makes that work. Because it seems like that's exactly the sort of, like, jovial, whimsicalness that should have stuck, and it didn't.
Right.
It's like Gateway also had this kind of feel to it, like, oh, we're funny, we have boxes with cows on them.
Yeah. So buy our PC generic clone.
Right. Let's see, what do I have left? I guess one thing that I put in my little list here was Palm, and I think I've mentioned them before too. Like, I feel like I used them, or whatever, but I feel a sort of a deeper like for them than just like they, I liked their Palm Pilot or whatever. Mm. I like them as a sort of a spunky young company.
Yeah, a little right. Plucky company.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the early Palm devices, like, they kind of opened up a new sort of category of computing that was, handheld, affordable computing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they obviously came out later than the Newton. They were technologically inferior to that and everything, but, like, the cost was so much smaller, especially when when the competitors like Handspring popped up. Mm-hmm. Like, that sort of environment was sort of, it was like suddenly it was at a price point and functionality point that was interesting for people to start to use 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. That, like, now everyone has a supercomputer in their pocket, but what that time nobody did. And suddenly it's like, oh, I can look at all the things that I can do while I'm sitting on the bus with this thing. Mm-hmm. So I have a warm spot for them. I don't know how much I can think of them as retro, though. Although I guess the first Palm Pilot probably came out in the mid or even early 90s.
A long time ago, yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be retro.
Yeah.
I think it would count. In fact, I think that was somebody who was asking that on our Facebook page, like, do PDAs count as retro? And then many diversions about public displays of affection,
which are more retro for some of us than others, but yeah.
Right. But yeah, I think the consensus was that they probably are. Because, I mean, like, we don't call what we carry around now PDAs anymore, right?
No, true.
Once it has a phone, it is no longer a PDA.
Right. So an iPad is just a really big PDA.
That's right. let's see. In the comments, Josh mentioned that the Maelstrom actually is still available on Ambrosia's site.
Oh, nice.
And I'm pretty sure, I'm pretty sure that I do. I have played that. I have picked that up and played that like within the last year, I think. But I remember.
I've not played it in forever, but I have very fond memories of it.
Yeah. And I think the sounds were great. Yep. What was it? There was another one. It was a Centipede game that I'm losing the name of, but I played that a lot too. And I never did play the what you were talking about that I barely remember the name of. EV. What was it? Something.
Oh, Escape Velocity.
Escape Velocity.
I think there were a few of those. EV Override. Yeah. And I think there were at least three games of that series, which were their, that was the big series from them, but I never played them.
Yeah, I wonder. Ambrosia had a software distribution model that I think did help get them out there into the world too. I mean, like, I think you could play and you paid if you were nice or something like that. There was some kind of nagware aspect to it that let you play them anyway.
Mm.
Okay. Anyway, this is interesting. It's interesting to think about these things.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think maybe was it last time? It might've been last time or two times ago. I think I mentioned a couple of other things like modem brands and stuff. Oh yeah, the Sportster.
Yeah, US Robotics Sportster. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
But anyway, I think we can probably move on to listener feedback. There is some. But listeners, you could write to us and tell us about your brand associations, all the things we missed.
I'm sure people are going to mention ones that I can't believe I forgot to mention.
Mm.
Oh yeah, yeah. It is funny how there is a sort of psychological attachment. Okay, let's see. So Anders wrote over email about the GoTek drives to just mention that there are a couple of different kinds of software that you could attach, you know, sort of flash into your GoTek drive if you're particularly, I think, for this is for Amigas, but and Anders recommends Flash Floppy. So there's a link to the GitHub page by Kira F. And actually, I should have looked this up, but Kira F, I think, is also one of the people who has done a lot of work on reverse engineering the CryoFlux format so that you can convert CryoFlux images into other images. So, interesting tangent. So Anders was saying that if you put one trick for doing using a GoTek drive with an Amiga is to put it in an external floppy chassis. You know, so if you have an external floppy and you don't want the insides, I guess, you could put a GoTek drive in there, and that keeps you, you know, then you can attach it like any external floppy could be attached. No drilling or you know, messing up your case.
Right.
So, and it is possible actually also to get newly made cable assemblies for connecting the GoTek as an external drive on eBay. And I found a couple. I don't know if these are the ones that he was referring to, but I have a link to a couple of these in our show notes that have external adapters and kit versions.
Cool.
Kev wrote over email saying that. So this is a sort of request for information from people. So back in the late 1990s or early 2000s, he used eBay with a program called the Oracle, which was is basically an eBay sniper. So you could set your amount, and it would at the last second, you know, submit a bid. It was doing this all with sort of like scraping techniques. So before eBay really had like third party APIs for this. And it was a Windows program that he remembers partly because it used these, I think they call it alpha channels or whatever, but it actually sort of made its own window in its own shape. It didn't use like Windows stuff. So Winamp did this also. And over the past 10 years, he's been searching for this program. Again, it's called the Oracle, an eBay sniper, with no luck trying to find any sign of it, and would like to get it, not to use it, but just to have it again. So if anyone knows, you know, that this was not a dream, I guess let us know and we will mention that.
Hmm.
But anyway,
yeah, I don't know it. I was never an eBay sniper person.
I am now, because I don't care about sportsmanship. I just want the thing.
Yeah, it always did seem unsportsmanlike to me. So it just seems un-Canadian snipe. I can't bring myself to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I sort of felt that way for a little bit, and then I sort of like stopped and thought.
You lost too many auctions.
What is that? Why does that? Who cares? but and actually, so I did look around a little bit to see if I could find anything myself in my own searching. Not, I don't know why I thought that I could, but I confirmed that I could not. But I did find a weird, very strange auction, which is a lot of 5694 PC, CD, DVD computer games from eBay store inventory wholesale.
It's kind of crazy how many discs are here.
Yeah.
Because you think it's just a bunch from the couple of pictures, but then the pictures keep going. And then it shows you racks and racks of boxed ones. And then more racks of just ones in cases. It's crazy how many discs this is.
It is. And you can buy it now for a little short of $13,000.
No, I won't.
But, yeah, I mean, so I think it must be that the word Oracle and eBay and Sniper, you know, came up in this list. Because if you go down this list,
there'd be a game, no doubt, has Sniper in it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I'm scrolling down and scrolling down and scrolling down. And you can imagine somewhere in there. Mm. I mean, like even searching the page.
Yep, good jewels of the Oracle. Slow. There's four of those.
Right. So this is what it says it is, by the way, is that it was an eBay seller, like the collection of an eBay seller, and this is now all being put together. It kind of sounds like it is not this person, not this eBay seller, but some other eBay seller took over the inventory of eBay seller number one, and for some reason you are being sold on the idea that you as eBay seller number three can make more of a profit than eBay seller number one.
But it could be that eBay seller number one died or got divorced and eBay seller number one's spouse is like, screw you, I'm selling your discs. Or who knows what. But I think it's got to be something like that.
Yeah. But good grief. Anyway, that was completely unrelated, but I was looking for the Oracle. And that's what I found.
Close. Yeah. Very close.
In the background of one of the photos is a Kansas City Royals rug of some sort. So it may be close enough to where Kansas Fest takes place that you could do local pickup and save yourself a little money.
Mm. Right. I think it's like $100 shipping and $13,000 to buy the thing. So.
Well, then, maybe it doesn't matter.
Jeff wrote over email, basically just to point out his channel, the Age of Gaming channel, where he's got some video. He's been doing videos of basically just things with his computers, and some of them they include an Altair 8800, a Sol 20, a Commodore PET.
But he's doing gaming on the 8800?
Well, I don't think it's actually a gaming channel. I looked at a little bit of these videos, and it's pretty cool, actually. They're nice. You can see, you know, using the Sol 20, and there are playlists for the Sol 20, for the Altair, for the PET. And if you look at the playlist, then you can see a couple of, you know, sort of things that are done. Like an introduction to one, creating a disk image using PC to flop, and so forth. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Cool.
And so I would recommend taking a look at them. It's, you know, actually, it's, I'm not sure that there are all that many such videos out there of people using Sol 20s. So it's good that some are coming to exist. I think the last one that I will mention is Kostas wrote, and then David forwarded this to us, about the CB2 micro kit. It's a microcomputer kit that you can build. The kit you can buy for basically £25, and the postage is £10 worldwide, and you can get it assembled if you want for an extra £10. I think it's coming from Greece. Is that what .gr is? But it looks pretty cool, actually. It's you know, it's not super expensive. Not a lot of pieces if you want to build your own. You know, it can connect with a PS2 keyboard, or you can use a USB keyboard if you have an adapter. It has RS-232 serial. It has Tiny Basic built in, and it can also run Chip 8, because everything can run Chip 8, we now learned. But also SChip and 8080 and AVR native binaries as well. And there's a, you know, kind of retro-looking page that has all this information on it, but it also has a fair amount of content. You can read the user manual and see how to load programs and save them. And I think there's something like 8 or 12, what do you call it? Stable RAM, right? Non-volatile. That's the word I was looking for, to save your programs and stuff. So
okay.
If you're interested, seems pretty cool.
Yeah, it does.
Cool.
All right, and I guess that will be it for the feedback, and we can now go to items of interest and news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
I was never a user or fan, as we discussed earlier, of CPM, but a lot of people were. And one of the cool things about CPM is very early on, there was a version of it that was networked, like from just the idea, like this is a networking operating system, CPM Net. And one of the neat things about the Z80, as us civilized people call it, or the Z80, as you monsters call it, was that it was a relatively cheap system. What was expensive back in the day wasn't the like the memory or the Z80. It was things like the disk. And so there was an idea that you could put together a thin client setup that would work on CPM. You'd have your each thin client would just have a Z80 processor and some RAM, and then you would be linking over to like a bigger system, a more expensive one that had little drives and that kind of stuff. So this kind of architecture existed for a long time. And one person looking into this, kind of Chris Fenton, said, well, how do I piggyback on this and this existing architecture to make the world's greatest CPM machine? And so he is putting together a 16-core, 83 megahertz Z80 powerhouse, and it's a portable computer, and it destroys everybody else's computer, and it's pretty fundamentally amazing. Because the idea is it's kind of like built into the system that's all talking to itself, and it's just put all this together into one thing that just acts as its own computer, and it's pretty amazing. So we're going to link to it's called the Zed Ripper, and we're going to link to part one on Chris's website where you can see it. It's really neat looking. He has a cool case, everything. It's like put together and currently functional. But there's nothing like having basically it's a retro computer, but it's a 16 core 83 megahertz retro computer. It's just a beast, and I love it. I love all the insanity of this, and it's really nice looking. So well, it's a homebrew, it's really cool and really well done, and I'm just so impressed by this whole thing. So I don't know if you guys have heard of this yet, or if our listeners have, but it's pretty amazing. And we will have a link to the show notes so people can follow along as there's more. And it's just, it does upwards to 35,000 floating point operations a second. And stuff like that. It's like, and it's an 8-bit CPU. So I just love it. This is crazy. So it's the Zed Ripper, and I think it's amazing.
That does seem pretty amazing.
If this existed back then, I would have been a CPM user.
You could play, Zork really quick?
Really quick, Zork. That thief is like, stab, 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 stab. That cursor's just blinking, wait. But yeah, so if you've ever wanted, like, just the CPM machine to end all CPM machines, I think Chris is making one.
Very cool.
Excellent. What I wonder is why stop at 16 cores? Why not go for 32, 64? There.
You're part of the problem.
All right. Jack, nice. Is the next thing here.
Oh yeah. So the next thing. So friend of the show, Ben Heck, this popped up. He has made this video came out just a week or two ago. A long time ago, for listeners who don't know, Ben Heck is a hardware hacker who builds amazing stuff, likes to take old computers and assemble them into new portable formats.
He did
things.
A portable 2GS, right? It was really nice looking.
Oh maybe, yeah. That one yeah. I haven't seen. So his latest thing is he made a brand new Atari 2600 portable, which he's done before, but this one is slightly different. So it's much smaller because it's built around a single chip design. So Atari for the 2600 that came out in 1977 had a number of chips on the board and like a bunch of support things. And it went through a number of revisions. Eventually in the later 80s, a later version of the 2600 Junior had all of the main circuitry smashed down into a single chip that was called the Janus chip. So it had the CPU, RAM, the video driver, all this stuff was all in one chip. And so Ben's project is to pull that chip out of one of those late model 2600 Juniors and make a new portable around it. And so along the way, you see his whole process of doing this, how he designs the case, how he fits the components, how he determines, you know, what to do with the screen and what sort of controller to make, and his whole... the whole way that he sort of creates this thing doing 3D printing and some laser etching and a CNC machine and all this stuff. And it's really, really cool. Really fun to watch.
It's a lot of work to play 2600 games.
Yeah. And then you get into what, play Pac-Man.
Yeah. So at some point he remarked on this being a never ending project. He clearly worked on this for a long, long time. I mean, you see it in the video is slightly under an hour, but it looks like it was probably filmed in chunks over weeks of time. Mm-hmm. So
it's picked up by successive generations of his sons yes. and daughters.
Yes.
the Heck legacy. We will get this done.
It was started by Ben Heck I, completed by Ben Heck the IV. That was really cool. I don't actually subscribe to his channel, but now and then YouTube presents me things from it because it knows I should like them. And this one I watched and I was like, yeah, that's really cool.
The funny thing is, I never actually knew what the difference between a 2600 and a 2600 Junior was, other than like a size. So I guess it's just everything slammed down into one chip.
Yep. Yeah. Smaller, cheaper. I think when they started, I think the early 2600 Juniors don't have this single chip design. But as they start producing them, they're like, hey, can we make this even cheaper? Let's make it down into one chip. So that's what they did. So, and he shows in the video externally, there's a way you can see on a Junior whether it is this model or not by flipping over and looking through the ventilation holes in the bottom.
Oh, so
you can
cool.
Because you can see the actual circuit board. And so looking for one pattern or another, you can tell, is this the multi-chip or the single-chip version? So if you're rummaging through bins of old 2600 Juniors, you can find the good ones if you want to emulate Ben's project.
That's nice.
Which looks like it's a hell of a lot of
work. Other than Yar's Revenge, what are the good games? Like, I actually literally don't know. Like, every once in a while, I'll pick up a 2600 or an emulator or whatever and play things, and I get, like, 5 minutes in any given game and go, well, this is terrible. Yar's Revenge can hold my interest. But there must be other ones. I used to have one years ago that I liked, but I don't recall any of the games. Do you guys have a suggestion? Like, if somebody picked up a 2600 and wanted to actually grab a game and play it for more than 5 minutes, what should they try?
Pitfall, right?
So I would say, I mean, from back in the day, there aren't really a lot of games that can really capture your interest for a longer length of time. There are some examples that can. So Pitfall and Pitfall 2.
Oh, Pitfall, yeah, that was good.
They're both things that you can get the idea within a few minutes, but to actually complete the game, which you can do, is challenging.
Wait, can you? I thought Pitfall was like a never ending. Is that you can actually win Pitfall?
You can actually win it, yes.
I'm learning so much on this this whole
yep.
thing we do here podcasting is just to teach me stuff, apparently.
You actually can complete Pitfall. I've not done it, but
no,
it's possible.
Apparently, now, you can all see how well I did at Pitfall, then, because I literally didn't even know you could finish.
Oh, you mean you can swing across one of those pits?
why is it called Pitfall?
You don't just walk into the pit and fall? I won!
Yes, I won. I won right away.
Keep winning. No, but so in Pitfall, there's a countdown timer clicking down, kind of like Prince of Persia. And so I think the idea is if you complete all 256 screens before the timer is done, then you win. I think that's the win state. I've never even gotten close. So I'm so far from ever winning that it's, you know, the chance that I ever will is very, very minuscule. But it can be done. So those are examples. Those can actually keep you engaged for a while. Other things like, probably Star Raiders ported to the 2600. I haven't played it on that, but if it works like the Atari 8-bit game, it's probably pretty good. Graphically not as good, I'm sure, but it's probably okay.
Was that a recent port, or did that exist back then?
No, that existed back then. So when you bought Star Raiders to the 2600, it came with a little sort of controller pad, like a 12-digit pad that you would plug in instead of joystick 2 for the like computer commands you would normally do with the keyboard.
Cool.
So... But I never played that.
I have BASIC for the 2600.
Really?
That is very funny.
Yikes.
I think... I
What kind of font is that using?
I mean, I should try to find images of this. But it comes with a... You mentioned the keypad, which is what reminded me. Because it comes with a little programmable keypad, like 12 buttons or something like that.
Yeah, I've heard about this, but I never used it. But I remember seeing something about the sort of remarkable technical feat that is... Atari 2600 BASIC, because you've got a machine that only has 128 bytes of RAM. So where does your program go as you're typing it in? And I guess the answer is that you can only have a very, very, very small program that you type in, and it can do very, very few things. Extremely limited.
Yeah, that's I think it's that you know your programs are like 9 lines long or whatever.
Right. Anyway, when it comes to 2600, I guess the more intriguing games are probably going to be the newer sort of homebrew games from today. Like there's somebody called Champ Games who's making really cool ports of, he's made a good version of Galaga and a good version of Mappy. And
Mappy is a great arcade game.
And he's made an amazing version of that for the 2600. It's mind blowing. If you like think of what the 2600 was 40 years ago and you see this, it's like that's incredible that this machine can do that. But he's figured it out.
As a kid, the only game that held my interest like forever, weirdly, the game that I kept in my 2600 was Combat, like the game I got as a packing game. And I adored it. And whenever I could get other people to play with me, that's the game I want to play. But you couldn't really play solo, so
right.
Disappointing. And I think because of that, that's the reason I ended up getting into television, because it had so many more single-player games.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Combat is kind of much maligned in a way, but it actually was a surprisingly large amount of variety of gameplay. There's a lot of stuff going on in there. And as long as you have two people, it was pretty fun.
There was some kind of Missile Command game I remember being really terrible.
I mean, I can think of lots of terrible games.
Yeah.
There was an Activision game. Kaboom. I liked Kaboom as well. I mean, we've kind of got off the rails here. This is beautiful. Yeah. But Kaboom. I dug Kaboom. I know there was others. I just couldn't think of any.
If you like Kaboom, you can see Ben Heck playing Kaboom on his device he created because he's testing his little paddle controller. He's got both a joypad and a paddle controller.
What I like to see, I don't game Ben Heck playing Kaboom. Is that like...
Who knows?
I think I did just see... That maybe is the Missile Command game.
Yes, that's Missile Command. That is like, it's not a Missile Command, it is Missile Command.
So technically now, because of the live stream, I'm watching Paul watch Ben Heck play Missile Command.
Right.
On his Atari 2600 Junior Mini that he's made. It's a beautiful world we live in.
It is.
And people who are not watching the live stream are just like, what the hell are you guys doing?
I can't tap her, I guess. I can't wait until somebody does a React video.
This is that.
No, someone reacting to this, to this live
exactly,
stream.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, excellent. That was me.
Okay, right. Okay, so this is Retro Recipes. I don't know, I believe that this is a channel we have come across before.
We've talked about this before, yes.
This is, but the thing was just recently posted, this video, December 14th, that was yesterday. But, so, the basic plot of this video is that there was an Amiga, I think it's not sure what type of Amiga. It was some type of Amiga. And it was thrown out by a movie studio. There we can see the Amiga in the movie studio. And it was put in the dumpster and retrieved from the dumpster. And then it was put in a shed, and then basically I think the person who had it didn't have space anymore in the shed, so contacted the Retro Recipes guy, and I mean, I think they already kind of knew what it was, but essentially it was a computer that was used. So in this thing, in this little like still shot in this video, it was used to run tracking for camera motion, right, on model shoots. And it was used by the people who worked on Apollo 13 and Titanic, and I think a couple other things too.
Oh, like the movies, though. They didn't work on Apollo 13. It worked on the movie.
It worked on the movies, yes. And so this machine was actually used to like run the camera controls. And in fact, actually also was used to do... So they explain this a little bit in the video. But when you're doing this kind of model work on film, which has to be developed, you don't know how it turned out until you develop the film, right? So they would actually put like little cameras in the viewfinders of the film cameras to record what the camera saw on tape or digitally in some way, so that they could see if they needed to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was another thing that this machine was for, was it was taking the video input from the viewfinder and then storing it. And so the thing is, though, this machine, you know, so first of all, there's a bunch of like corrosion and stuff on it, and so there's some discussion of like trying to fix the corrosion in it, and it's all kind of hypey.
Sure,
it's all kind of hypey.
But at any rate, so they try to fix some of the boards that had corrosion on it, and they, you know, ended up swapping in this and that and the other thing. They ended up having to replace a power supply. And I think in the end, they just transplanted the hard drives to a different machine.
That's one solution.
But in the end, it turned out that there actually was captured video on this. So, property of Lightstorm Entertainment. And you can see you know, some of the video of like the Titanic going by and like the little submersible going down to it and stuff. And it's, so it is actually like video captured in the studio at the time from the viewfinder of like even stuff that maybe didn't even make it into the movie.
Cool.
So that's pretty wild.
That is very wild.
Yeah.
That's pretty neat.
So if you want to see that, other things that are cool about this are that the imaging that is described there, it has been uploaded to the Internet Archive.
Nice.
So if you want to get this data off, there was actually a hard drive that was separate from the ones in the video. They found like another one. And so all of these things have been uploaded here in image files and hard drive files. And from what I understood from what they said in the video, although I don't entirely buy this, but it's not really possible to get these videos out even under emulation. You know, you kind of need to take these and put them on a real machine. And it might be just that the video card itself is not being emulated, but the data is here. It has been preserved. So cool. That is very cool. And if you wanted the physical objects, the way I found it actually was that there's an eBay auction that has the stuff. So if you wanted to get the actual stuff, you can get the actual stuff. And so I saw this auction and I thought, ah, that's nonsense. It's just somebody selling something. But that led me down all the rest of the trail. You know, so this is the actual computer from the set of Apollo 13, The Abyss, Titanic. And currently it is up to $710 after 6 bids.
That's very cool. I also think it's pretty cool. At the beginning of this section, I actually had to ask you to clarify whether this was the Amiga used in the actual Apollo 13.
That's right.
It was the Amiga that went up with you. I asked, what now?
On the moon.
I really have no sense of when the Amiga was actually used. It could have been 1970. It could be now. I don't know. I'm here for color commentary.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was the story. The story of an eBay auction that expanded into something bigger.
Cool.
Oh, that's a good segue to my bit of news.
All right. So what is your big bit of news?
There was, a couple weeks ago, a floppy disk signed by Steve Jobs heading up to auction, expected to fetch ridiculously $7,500. Was it? And it wasn't even like a really fancy disk. This wasn't like a version of the Mac operating system that was never released or source code. No, it's a Macintosh system tools disk, like just your basic systems tool disk, just a 3.5-inch floppy with a slightly smudged Steve Jobs signature on the front of it. Ridiculous auction going up at a place called RR Auction in Boston. So this is one you missed there, Paul. And I expected it to fetch $7,500. Well, the auction happened and it actually went for $84,000. And nobody's quite sure why, but it went. So it's a System Tools version 6. And if somebody really needed that floppy and said, look, I can't get my LC2 to operate or something, and they're just desperate, this was one way to get it. I don't know. I'm sure Steve Wozniak is saying, I give out my signature all the time. What's going on? but yeah, so a floppy disk version of System Tools with a felt tip, slightly smudged Steve Jobs on it went for $84,000. And our eBay picks seem really tame by comparison.
Yeah.
We have a link to a write-up from Apple Insider in advance of the auction saying, remarkable, this might go as high as $7,500. And then we'll have a link to the RR auction site for the closed item 333. And weirdly, the item was just 333 Steve Jobs. Now, I wonder if people were thinking they were getting something else. Like, Steve Jobs, awesome. I'll bid 80 grand. Give me that frozen bit or whatever. But just a floppy disk. Minimum bid was 1,000. Went for a little over 84,000.
You know, but if you look at it, I hope it was authenticated in some way because doesn't look like much. It looks, you know, you could copy that off the inside of your Mac if you
wanted
to.
Doesn't even say whether or not the disk was working.
Yeah. Does it even work? Come on.
Wow. All right.
Yep. Wow. That's something.
Good going, people.
I don't get it. I don't know what's fancy about this one, but it went for a bundle.
All right. Jack, do you have anything auction related to give us?
Nothing auction related, but I do have something else, which is this thing called Silly Venture, which I've been hearing of for a few years and keep forgetting to mention in this context. So it's an annual event in Poland focusing on Atari computers, both the 8-bits, the ST, and also even things like Jaguar and the other video game systems, where a lot of the content of this is like an old-style European computer demo party, where different sort of coding groups present their demos, their graphics demos and sound and stuff, things they're working on. And this happened just this a week ago, I think, and I started seeing it pop up on Facebook. And some of the videos here are just really, really cool. So, like, if you enjoy things like old 8-bit computer graphics and chiptunes and other fun stuff, you can find plenty here. Heck, I can do the thing. I can share my screen, can't I?
Quite possibly.
So this is one. This is a demo called Far Away Party Version.
Mm-hmm. Party.
Party, party. And just it has some pretty sweet stuff. I'm like, we don't have to sit and watch the whole thing, but there's a lot of stuff. There's a cool, like, there's a cool soundtrack going on here. There's a lot of cool motion and crazy things. Stuff that, you know, no one at the time would have thought was possible probably on an Atari 8-bit computer, but here we are. Mm-hmm. Just neat things, and it's fun that these things are still going on, and I think it's interesting that a lot of these things are in places like Poland, where, like, in Poland, Atari 8-bit computers were new in the late 80s and early 90s. Like, this because in Eastern Europe, a lot of countries didn't really have computers at all under the Soviet era. And Jack Tramiel, who was from East Europe originally, he was trying to sell off old Atari stuff, and he said, hey, let's market these to Eastern Europe. So for a lot of people, these were sort of the first computers that were available in the 90s. And so to this day, there is a pretty substantial set of interesting hardware and software that ends up being produced in Eastern Europe that are software for the Atari 8-bits or hardware add-ons, that sort of thing. So it seems fun. I don't know if I would ever go to this because I don't know if they're speaking Polish the whole weekend. I don't know if I would just, but I'm sure I'd have a good time anyway. It seems like a fun thing. So the link that I'm putting in the show notes is a link to a playlist that I found on YouTube that contains a number of these things. I have not watched all of these by any stretch, but there's a ton of them and they're all pretty fun and crazy things to look at visually. So I recommend it to anyone who enjoys these things.
Cool. Very cool.
Never heard of this before at all.
Nope.
Yeah, I've heard of Silly Venture in the past, but I haven't ever done anything. When it comes to our show, I always forget to mention it somehow. Just like it doesn't pop up to me that I should be talking about this.
We'll also have a link. I found the official site for Silly Venture 2K19, so we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well.
Cool. Excellent.
Yeah. Very cool.
Okay. So. So the motivation for my looking at this topic was that I was looking for eBay auctions because I don't know any of the actual news. All I do is look for eBay auctions, but everything's sort of based on an eBay auction I found. But so I found which is a Timex Sinclair 2068 personal color computer, complete in box, and it's got a nice box. It has no manual though, but otherwise it's in good shape. They're actually kind of nice looking computers. They are, I think we've probably talked about them before. They're kind of like a Spectrum, but they're not Spectrum compatible. They're sort of like the US version of not a Spectrum.
Right. You know, most computers are not a Spectrum.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it special.
Right. But it's close. And you can get a little thing, if you introduce the Spectrum ROM to it, then you can run a lot of Spectrum things.
Why don't they call it the Spectrum?
I hope they do, but I don't know if they do. I think they call it like a Spectrum emulator or something. It's nothing too exciting. But so it doesn't have the manual, and that sort of reminded me of the fact that today there was a message on the Yahoo groups for the TS-2068 that said basically, okay, well, that was fun while it lasted. See ya. Because the Yahoo groups itself has shut down. And it was with not very much warning, and basically on the day that it shut down, which was supposed to be yesterday, we got this message to the list saying, well, I haven't really been participating much in this list, I saved some of the files in a zip file if you want them, email me. And it's like, and then that's it. And so it's actually pretty much deteriorating here, I think it is possible to look at the Oh, no. Actually, now all the links are not working anymore. Oh, it's because I'm not signed in. But I think even if I signed in, you know, if I clicked on a message, it would show, it would, like, I could see the title and maybe a blurb. But if I actually click on it, the message isn't there. So it's kind of sad because that means all of this information, it was going since 2001. And everything that we have learned about sort of modern uses of the Timex Sinclair 2068 through discussions and things are no longer. The files are findable, presumably because they were saved. But the Yahoo itself has said that even though the content is not going to be viewable anymore from yesterday, they are going to request, they'll respond to requests for archival, you know, like a zip file or whatever, of the groups up until January, whatever it says, January 31st. So it is still possible to do that if there's a private group that, you know, you need to subscribe to get into, and the owner is still active, you know, they can ask for this. But anything, obviously, you know, any group that sort of like ceased activity a year and a half ago or whatever.
Okay, hold on. I thought you were saying the Yahoo group for the Timex Sinclair was shutting down. You're saying like all Yahoo of groups, Yahoo groups are shutting down.
They're all gone, yeah. As of yesterday.
All going away.
Oh, okay. And
a lot of people moved to Groups.io or, you know, other places, but that only works if there are, you know, like right now people are paying attention. And there was a very short time window for this too. So it's kind of bad. It's not good at all. There is an archive team page about this, you know, sort of talking about it, that talks about what happened and some of their efforts for, you know, like grabbing what they can. But of course, they can only grab public things. Mm. So the private ones, you need to actually, if you are an admin, you need to request the data from Yahoo. And apparently, you can only do it with Windows. So that's why the TS2668 group is going away, because you need a Windows installation. You have to install the exporter, which is a Windows program, and the guy didn't have Windows.
This is crazy. Also, I don't understand how much does it take Yahoo to keep these things running, like to not do anything.
Yep.
I don't understand why a company would shut these down or shut them down without a ton of notice and say, look, we're not putting any resources in. Eventually, this is going to stop working. So let's go on notice and say 2 years.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. That was not. Let's see. So let's see if it says uploading of new content was disabled 28 October. I don't know when the announcement was, but at any rate, I think if you were on an active Yahoo group, you probably heard this from various angles. But if you later want to, you know, if you weren't and you later want to go find this stuff, it's possible that the archive team has saved some of it. Who knows?
Maybe. Yeah. You know?
So it had received some media attention. This, for example, the Office of Communications, the wireless regulators in the United Kingdom, rely on Yahoo groups to port phone numbers to sort of communicate amongst the companies. And so now it's unclear exactly how they're going to deal with this. But anyway, like I'm not actually sure what the mechanism is that they use Yahoo groups for, but essentially that is sort of how they tell each other like which blocks of numbers they're taking. So that's that. Timex Sinclair 2068 knowledge is at risk unless and so are many other things. I mean, I looked at my Yahoo groups list and I'm on like 30 or something like that, you know, and they're all gone. So anyway.
So you've got a link, a couple more links here about the UK phone numbers, but also I just found one from a couple days ago about how Verizon is actively blocking the archive groups because what they've done is they've blocked all the email addresses that the archive team uses. So they've been trying to log in. So archive team can log into Yahoo groups, set up an account, say, okay, I want to join, and then download all the information. So Verizon has now banned all their addresses.
Yeah.
So they can't make accounts. Why?
It's quite mysterious, but I mean, like it's, you know, so I was a subscriber to this particular group. And since like 2016 or something, I've got the last 2 years, but I don't have like 2011 or 2001 to 2015. So anyway,
Usenet, people.
Yep.
Still going strong.
That's right. Okay, let's see. So I guess we've hit the end of the
internet, apparently.
Right.
Yes.
Well, right.
It's done.
Being shut down and nobody's allowed to save anything.
I'll mention that the upcoming show roundup is the next thing to mention. Nothing has changed there. We might still be missing some, but at any rate.
Probably.
The things that I have listed are VCF Pacific Northwest, March 21st and 22nd in Seattle at the Living Computer Museum Plus Labs, where we promised you could meet Earl.
That's right.
29th annual Last Chicago Cocoa Fest, April 18th to 19th, 2020. So shortly after VCF Pacific Northwest. And then VCF East, shortly after that, April 24th to 26th at the InfoAge Center in Wall, New Jersey. So go to some, go to all. And I guess with that, a word from our sponsor.
When you run a small business, problems can leave you groping in the dark.
You couldn't sleep either, huh?
Unless you have a reliable guide, like the Texas Instruments Professional Computer.
We do it by Tuesday?
It helps you control inventory, check alternate schedules, and gives you answers today. So tomorrow dawns as planned.
Mike, I've got it.
Right.
The TI Professional Computer. See your Sunday paper for our free memory expansion offer.
I know, you think you're going to be the one person in the world who can't operate a computer. You think you won't even be able to hook it up and it'll sit on your shelf mocking you. Well, this is how easy it is to get started with the new Atari XL home computer. Once you get the whole system set up, there are over 2,000 things you can do with it. Just plug this into here. Very easy, because there's only one place it goes, and there, you're ready to go.
26 seconds.
I can go again. I can do it much faster. Go again. Let's go again.
And we're back. And so today, for the host retro computing gift idea, we have something sort of thematically similar to something we had before, but it's holiday season again. It's actually relatively cheap. And
so are we.
Might actually be appreciated. I can imagine people might want this. I don't know. But it is the Carmen Sandiego handheld computer game. It is almost identical looking to the Oregon Trail handheld computer game of a couple of years ago. But, you know, so it's in this little sort of handheld shape. It has a little screen, which I think is running. Somebody figured this out, but it might be an NES version of this game or a PC version. I think the chip inside might well be an NES on a chip. So this is a game I almost never played, but I know a lot of people like. So if you want to play, I guess it's Where in the World Is Carmen Sandiego.
Yes.
Yeah. Then you can buy this. It's at least right now, as I'm looking at it, it's like $14 at Walmart. So I mean, it's like nothing.
That's very cheap.
Yeah.
The physical, like the chunky box of the game, like the physical aspect of it, mm-hmm. is very reminiscent of like an old toaster Mac.
Yeah.
Ignore the buttons on the bottom, but like the top part of it looks like you're looking at an old Mac Plus or something.
Mm-hmm. And then that floppy disk thing is actually the power button.
Yeah, big red horizontal line that looks like a floppy disk is the power button. But it really harkens back to a Macintosh Plus.
Yep.
So it is potentially kind of incoherent in its messaging, but but it's still, you know, it hits various nostalgia buttons.
Sure.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, so this one, as I said, I never played it very much. And if you read the reviews are kind of mixed. Mm-hmm. So there are the people who said, oh, I remember playing this in school. This is great. I love this. And there are people like, this is nothing like the TV show.
I was going to say, I wonder how many people think this is something off the TV show, which is probably a bigger audience and more likely what people think they're getting.
Right.
And I feel like I don't know almost anything about either the game or the TV show. Like, I don't know when these things were current, like in the world. Is this game, does the game predate the TV show or did it come after? Or like, I have
game
no idea.
The game predates the TV show, definitely. Yeah.
It does. Okay.
Yeah. It's like from 87 or 88 or something, I think.
Probably. Okay.
I'm not sure that it actually is for kids. It might well be for ex-kids.
Right. People who were kids when it was a new game. Yeah.
Former kids.
Which is our audience. So.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good choice for a house gift.
Yep, definitely.
All right. So now we can move on to eBay auctions. And Carrington, you have several.
I've got the first few. You can have the final 30. So my first one is a book choice. A lot of times you don't want to pick a book on eBay because a lot of times you can go to Abbey Books, which we have a few episodes where we talk about how that's pronounced, but right. Abbey Books. But I picked Computer Lib, the Ted Nelson book. In here it's listed as Ted Theodore Nelson, which seems like right out of Bill and Ted. Ted Theodore Nelson. So Computer Libs / Dream Machines, fairly famous book. Most of our audience probably knows what it is. This is a first edition of it. There were lots of, this is the ninth printing though, it's from 1974. There are lots of those. It's $100 buy it now. Seems like a lot of money, but the reality is that's cheap for this book. This thing comes up a lot, and it's usually in the $200 to $300 range, whether you find it on Abbey Books or eBay or whatever. So if you wanted this thing, I don't think you should spend $100 on this book. Ted Nelson didn't think you should spend $100 on this book. Oh my gosh. But if you want one and you're a collector and you've been holding off trying to get a copy of this book in decent shape without writing all over it, it looks in rough shape, but that's just how the printing looks. Like, the cover of this is very zine-like. So for $100, it's actually I hate to call it a good deal because I don't think it is, but a better deal than you'll usually find. So I selected it just because it's a thing that people might want, and it's about half the price that you often see on eBay. For $100, buy it now. That's the first choice. Much more interesting, I think, are my second two choices, which are both word processor related, kind of. The first one is a cassette. I love cassettes, and it's the Electric Pencil for TRS-80. Electric Pencil is kind of the first word processor, as we think of what a word processor is. When you think of all the things you can do with a word processor, Electric Pencil is kind of the first one of those. It's just one person made them for a bunch of different operating systems, and it really couldn't compete eventually with all the other word processors that came out because it was just one guy making all the versions and writing from scratch for every operating system. But still, very cool, and this is a very early version, 1978. So if you want a very early version of the Electric Pencil, not for the first operating system he came out for, but this is probably one of the earliest versions that came out for the TRS-80, you can grab yourself a cassette. Cool. It is, how much is it? $50, buy it now. So that's fun. More fun is, you'll probably remember at the time, back then and kind of today, the combination of Luddite plus dad joke gives us this. The LEAD 2.5 word processor. My gosh. So what it is this little plaque with, I'm not sure if it's just photos or actual pencils in it. So it's LEAD, which I guess stands for, what does it stand for? It says somewhere in here somewhere.
Late, economical, and dependable.
Right. Yeah. So it's a pencil. So it's one of those things that argues, you know, the old way is better. You people and your fancy computers, this is from 1984. And I distinctly remember from the 70s to early 90s, many, many, many products like this, which were all like, oh, the old way is better. Let me put this up. Isn't it hilarious? Why use those fancy word processors where you can use this pencil? Look, it can erase words. And then it talks about how there's other models, like one that's sharpened at both ends, where you don't make any mistakes. One that just has erasers at both ends, if you only make mistakes, blah, blah, blah. You can have a good, fast, or cheap pick two, that sort of thing. So it's a pencil. It's a pencil being pushed as a word processor. Why is it version 2.5? I don't know. But it's dad joke / Luddite / absolutely evocative of the time period. So old people who were afraid of computers used to put this up in their janky offices in the 1980s.
Yeah. Yep.
You want a janky 1980s office, you can hang this sucker with pride.
Especially that the headline at the top is in this sort of old computer font.
A Micker.
Right, yes. It's as if Colossus, voice of world control, is speaking you, the LEAD 2.5. Yeah. So it can be fine or large print. It says letters, words, or entire phrases can be deleted with the flick of a wrist. Polished wooden cabinet. Okay. Unlimited memory capacity depending upon the aptitude of the user. So there you go.
Yep.
1984, my goodness. So those are my choices.
Just trying to think about like what the life of this would be. You know, like how long was there before, but like between when people were starting to get into computers and the you know, the older generation were cranky about it and when they were everywhere. I mean, and I guess it was long enough to put up a plaque.
If you listen to our show, we are now the older generation who's cranky about stuff.
That's right.
But you know, a thing like this, I could still imagine somebody like my mother and stepfather receiving this as a gift and finding it hilarious and relevant.
Yep.
Because
I'm sure there
who...
are offices today that still have this up. Somebody got this thing in 1984, and some accountant somewhere still has this on his wall.
Yeah.
Right.
I say his because you know it's a dude.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, we do know that it is funny, though, because it is told to us in the auction title.
It's important for you to know.
Yeah.
Funny. Pencils. Funny.
Funny.
So if you were searching for funny pencils, this would come up.
Exactly. So anyway, it is $35, and we just lost a bunch of interesting people on that. $35, but it's framed, so yeah. ready to hang.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. We should have picked this as the gift suggestion.
Yeah.
Perfect Christmas gift for your Luddite parent.
I bet you could sell this as a kit pretty easily.
Absolutely, you could.
All right. Well, so I have a little pile of things. There's no coherent anything to them. I'll mention them until I get tired of mentioning ones.
I dig it.
Or until you tell me you are tired of me mentioning ones.
Not going to happen.
But so the first thing is, it is a Apple II graphics tablet. As we record, there are 4 hours left, so it's not going to be there for very long. But I thought it's kind of interesting just in its completeness, so I kind of wanted to show it just for that. Because these are things that they're actually really big. I guess you can sort of tell by how big it is compared to like the Apple II card by it up on the corner there. But it's pretty common that you find the sort of like the plate, the sheet, transparent sheet that has the grid on it. That'll have fallen off, or it won't have the manual, or it won't have the card, or it won't have the pen. All these things are needed. And this one even has the box, which is I think extra cool. It's cool to see these boxes. Of course, when they were made, they were just like shipping boxes. They weren't made to be collectibles. They're just a functional box.
Right,
right.
But it's still cool to see them.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of tape wear. It's neat to see actually graphics tablet written out, in the Apple font. And they are rare enough, and I think people are aware that like this is complete enough that it is currently at $304 after 13 bids. Anyway, if you were interested to see, they do exist on eBay.
So I've never seen one of these in use. Like, what is the actual? Does it work like a drawing tablet we think of today, just much bigger, or is it like what software could you use this with and do things with?
Well, it had to be something that would interact with the interface card.
Mm-hmm.
I've never hooked it up and tried to do anything with it. One thing I do know that they're sort of famous for is they're magnetic. So if you want to lose all the data on your disk, you just set it right on the graphics tablet.
Awesome.
A nice big flat surface for setting disks on.
Great. Bonus feature.
You can maybe set your other ones on top of the monitor and on your guitar amp.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a 3.5-inch disk at one point in college that like fell off my desk, and I had a guitar amp next to it. And so a guitar amp, this one in particular, was like, it's just like a big speaker that has a big magnet in the back. And so the disc just went, because it has a little metal
That's the best way to erase this. Just from across the room, you just like flick them at your amp. I play this one into obscurity with my metal.
But I think it does basically just communicate to whatever software is using it, what the X and Y coordinates are. And I don't know if I can zoom in on this, but the this thing at the top has little commands. So it goes with some drawing program. That you can tap viewport or view reset or delta. I think there were some things that were made for it, but don't know what. Future report. So the next thing I had, this is a direct 825 terminal, and it's labeled as it says rare vintage Apple tagged computer direct incorporated model 825. So it came up in my lists because I was searching for Apple. It has very little to do with Apple, except that tag. So it just means that somebody had this at Apple.
Right.
But it's a terminal. It's surprisingly difficult to search for these. So let me see if I can. It looks like a little compact or whatever. It actually has a pretty big screen. I think it's a 9-inch screen. It may even be long, bigger than that. But and I think this company could, like, if there was another one, we talked about one in February 2016 on episode 120. And so I went back to look at that because I kind of remember just talking, like, I think Earl was on that one and we were talking about this and it took a little while to figure out what it was. And 2016 is a long time ago. I feel like we just had this conversation. I don't understand how it could have been, you know, almost 4 years ago. But anyway, but it is actually really pretty difficult to find information about these. But apparently they were, you know, they were a thing at the end of 1982. So I found a little link in a Computer World at some point that talked about them. And they look nice. And this one does seem to work. It's because you can find no information about it. I think probably also because direct is not a very searchable word. Not like Tumblr or whatever. You know,
right.
It has all the vowels, so you can't find it.
I disagree with the whole it looks nice thing, though.
Really?
It's kind of industrial design with the, you know, the flip down. It's like a Osborne type idea.
Mm-hmm.
Big lumpy case with a flip down cover that's your keyboard and a small built-in monitor or inbuilt monitor.
Mm-hmm.
Never dug those. Didn't like them then, don't like them now. This one's also very dirty.
It is very dirty.
Yeah.
True.
Used at Apple, not clean since.
I don't know. I kind of like the color scheme. All right. The next one I had is, I just always find this funny. It came up and I thought I would link to it. It is the Broderbund Software's VCR Companion.
Oh, this thing.
It is outdated in many levels. But it's actually, so what it actually is a titler, basically. So you know, it comes on floppy disks, and I think probably it says on the back somewhere. This, I guess we don't have very much information on this auction, but that's interesting. It says 3.5-inch disk, and then what we see are 5.25-inch disks.
Yeah.
So I guess you could get it in both formats. And I've seen it in actually school versions, too. You know, like this is the kind of thing that schools would order. Which I could see, but I mean, so essentially you just make titles for your wedding videos or whatever, school projects.
It is weird, though. You're right. The box definitely, like the box itself has a label that says 3.5-inch disc for Apple II, but then it's 5.25-inch discs actually in the auction. That's strange. So that's not, these did not come together.
Yeah, although I think you can probably send in for the format you didn't have.
Oh, so is that still available as an offer?
But then you can get the manual. I don't know if this is the one I scanned. I have this somewhere, but it might be. This might be my own scan. But
anyway, oh, let's judge it.
You can right. Okay. Well, I think I would have made it a long time ago. But looks
still,
pretty lined up.
Judging is forever.
Okay. anyway, I just think it's funny that it exists, and there's a 4 a.m. crack of it if you want to run it. Unprotected. Copyright 1988. Okay. What is this? Oh, yes. It's the gift-giving season. So this is it's a MacPlay board games gift box that comes with Risk Deluxe, Scrabble, and Monopoly for your, you know, whatever era Mac that would be. I think 68K Mac, right?
I would have assumed. Yeah, they're all System 7 things, so 68K Macs.
This is beyond the era when I collect stuff, really. So
this is too newfangled for you?
Yeah. I mean, I think it might be kind of cool to have. It might be good to preserve and scan and that kind of thing. But like, I don't have super deep knowledge about how these things were sold. But nevertheless, I've never seen a gift pack with all three. So
right.
I know I've seen all three games individually, but mm-hmm. I too have never seen the gift pack. So if somebody is a Mac Play completionist,
yeah,
this one's for you.
You know, Mac Play is actually another company that I feel a certain kind of fondness for. They made games that all our PC friends could play, you know, available to us.
Right, because a year later or so, everybody would say, well, the PCs have enjoyed it for a couple of years, so why don't you have a version of it now?
Yeah.
And I was thankful to get them.
So they were mainly porting PC games to Mac? Was that kind of their thing?
I think that's
how I think
likely.
Of them, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, these may not be the best examples of those, but I'm pretty sure Mac Play was the one who was responsible for, well, I don't actually know how all these companies fit together. I think of them as being partly responsible for like the Doom and, you know, Doom 2 and those things. But it's also GT Interactive is in there somewhere, and I'm not sure which company is what they do. It's probably findoutable. Maybe it's actually at GT Interactive that I liked, but I mistakenly liked, I think I like MacPlay.
No, I remember there's lots of MacPlay games. My memory is things like Wolfenstein 3D and Out of This World, Alone in the Dark, definitely the three of those, which I love, were MacPlay games. So probably the Fallout series 2, I think, was MacPlay. So lots of stuff from the 90s I dug.
Mm. Cool. All right. Let's see. Oh, here's another one of the shape that Carrington likes. This is the... I picked this because I'd never heard of this thing before. I looked it up a little bit and tried to figure out something about it. It is the Texas Instruments Portable Professional Computer. So they made a PC, but it's not IBM compatible. Already...
Well, maybe it predates IBM compatible stuff. Because there's that weird period where Texas Instruments came in and destroyed all the calculator people. Uh-huh. And everyone got shook up. Like, I can't believe like somebody could come in and like take over an industry that way, blah, blah, blah. And then Osborne, it's after that Osborne comes out and starts being so amazing with their clone thingy. But I think a lot of people thought it's because of the clone stuff. But I think it was really just you could get the Osborne and the software that came with it was cheaper than like... Right. And so it was really the cheapness was popular and the fact that you could take it home when your company went under, that kind of thing. So, like, who knows where this slots in?
Well, it says in, you know, the internet, on the internet it says that it was introduced January 31st, 1983.
So, oh, okay.
So that is right there in the early PC time. What was the PC was 82, I think, right?
And surely this is within a close enough time span that, like, as a business decision, betting on not being IBM compatible was not a given failure. Right. Like, it was a crapshoot at that point. Like, who knew what was going to be? You know, it could have been that not being Texas Instruments Professional Portable compatible would have been the downfall of any other company.
Right.
Had things gone a different way.
Yeah. Okay. I just looked it up on computer history. And 1983 is when the Compaq Portable comes out. So that's the first, you know, 100% compatible one.
Right.
So 83 is that year.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, and the Lisa came out too.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, and the Bernoulli box. That took off.
Well, they sound like they do. But
well played.
I like my Bernoulli box. That was another one of those things that I have nostalgia for no good reason. Well, I mean, it's because I, you know, worked with them. The guy who had the color discs and the QX10s also had a bunch of Bernoulli boxes. Boxen.
But Bernoulli people definitely would say Boxen.
Yeah. I have a mug, in fact, that says iOmega on it. And the only reason I have it is for that nostalgia. The other thing about this is it has actually a pretty big screen. Again, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
if
for
it's
that form
12,
factor, it's quite a big screen. Yes. Yeah. Mm. Like 4 inches.
It looks like it's kind of a nice, you know, machine in general. These existed in color. But this is not a color one.
I'm listening in black and white, so I wouldn't.
It's a $400 buy it now. So if you've never heard about this before, you can now see photos of it. I mean, they were super expensive initially.
I'm sure. But
nevertheless, I think I'm not quite ready to spend $400 on it.
Even though it sounds like a good deal, like, what would you do with it?
Yeah, well,
you shouldn't spend $400 on it.
Well, I think it does. I think it does do CPM, doesn't it?
But is it as fast as a 16 processor? 83? My CPM bar has been raised considerably in the last hour.
Yeah.
We have a whole new standard to go after now.
All right. And then just there are a couple other things. Okay, so here's a Kenbeck 1 replica. We talk with some frequency about the existence of the Kenbeck 1 and the questions about whether it was the first computer or whether it was the first anything. Whatever it was, here's a kit that you can assemble. It's the Micro Kenbeck 1. Actually, I think it's assembled. I mean, there's a picture of an assembled one. Yeah, I think it's made already. And you can see it's sort of like 3D printed back. It has little LEDs and however many keys that is. 10, 8, 12, 14 buttons on the front. And, you know, I assume it works in the way that the Kenbeck one did. So if you...
Works, in quotes.
Yeah, so if you wanted to play around with that.
Play in quotes.
The title says "Rare Kenbeck 1 Replica Working Museum Item Makers IoT Atmel." Trying to capture everybody.
Right.
And so questions and answers. Question one: is it museum quality? Answer: well, if your museum is a roadside attraction that also sells fireworks, maybe.
That is a very excellent answer.
Yeah, I like that. But it's pretty cool, though. I mean, it's actually kind of a neat thing, and it's a $90 buy it now, and I think that's probably not unreasonable. It's a built kit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And
it
looks pretty nice. No one's going to be fooled into thinking you have an actual Kenbeck one.
No.
Even if you put tape over the micro part at the beginning. It might actually be smaller. I don't actually know how big a Kenbeck one really is.
Because if it's smaller, then it's, like, when I look at it, it looks correct from my memory,
yeah,
which isn't strong at the Kenbeck one. So if it is smaller, then everything is scaled down.
Right. It's, I mean, it's definitely shallower.
Oh, that's it. Yes. Oh, yeah. I kind of didn't realize that.
Basically,
I only looked at the first couple of photos.
But,
yeah, it's super thin. I wonder why they would do that then. Like, why not make it the same depth?
Well, it's 3D printed, so I suppose that's also maybe, you know, it would take a week to print it.
Yeah. But still, the whole point, it's a replica.
How deep was the original? Are we talking like the shoebox length or?
I don't know. Good question.
Kind of almost, not, I'd say like 80% as deep as it is wide.
Okay.
Okay. Like it's a big thing. Like when you hold it up, it's, you know, this.
It's the size of a,
I was holding a kid back and be like that.
Okay.
For those of you listening at home, I'm holding a large fish that got away.
So there are two more things in my list. Neither of them are as interesting as the ones I was pointing out before. But this is for all of the many Commodore enthusiasts that we have on this podcast today.
Mm-hmm.
This is a Expander 4 for that, which is basically just lets you plug in four different cartridges at once. I think you switch between them, and this is actually from the day, you know, so this is an expander that you could get back in the olden days, and it looks
cool.
Dirty and kind of ugly and
appropriate.
Yeah.
But, ask me if I'm in favor of even more Commodore expander, please. How about a Commodore compressor?
Yeah.
The one thing I like is that it has a fuse.
Yep.
It has a fuse right on top of the circuit board. You can change in case you need to change that fuse for some reason. Like, I don't know what the purpose of this, like what sort of voltage is going through this that needs to be.
Yep, it has a big old red reset button and a fuse, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool. I dig it.
Yeah, although if you plug in an Apple II disk drive wrong, you can make some pretty impressive little sparks, even though it's not,
okay, sure,
not that much. I mean, whatever it is, it's a 12-volt difference, right?
Yeah, I can short anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. And so this is an expander for the cartridge port, I guess, right?
Right. So I don't know I'm not sure.
Maybe, I don't know how these things are slotted. Maybe it's possible to insert a Commodore cartridge the wrong way around and then you're hosed. I don't know.
That seems like a very unfriendly computer thing to do.
Yeah. But, like, I don't know if that's an issue or if that's even possible, but like, I don't see anything limiting. There's no sort of bracketing around there that would seem to limit a cartridge going one way or the other on that. So maybe that's why. Got to have that fuse.
Interesting. Yeah, they are. It's totally symmetrical. I kind of hope they thought of that. Because, I mean, you know, little kids are supposed to be using these, right?
Right.
Okay, and then the last one.
Is your best option in forever.
Yeah, the anti-radiation filter.
For real. The anti-radiation filter. Sold untested.
Yep.
I love it.
But it's pretty cool. It's not only is it... like a glare guard, but it also says that it blocks 99% of ELF, VLF, E-field radiation. And I had been kept sleepless worrying about that. But it actually, it gets rid of static by having a ground wire to an outlet. So you need another outlet for your glare guard.
Mm-hmm. It's the best. I love it. I want to get this.
Yeah. So it's in nice shape, though. And it's not super expensive. I mean, it's a $10 starting bid.
And it's in box.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
Cool.
But that the plug that it comes with, though, is great because it's designed to plug into a North American three-prong outlet.
Yeah.
Yes.
But all of this is a ground wire, right? So you've got your bottom pin, the lower of the one, that's a ground wire. The other two are just plastic inserts going, yeah, you know what? You're hot, you return. We don't, the white, the black mean nothing to us. We're all ground all the time. So it's literally just a wire that you're going to shove into the bottom port of the outlet.
Right.
And how much you want to bet that if you ever saw this in use in an actual like office space or something, that three-prong plug we plugged into an adapter lets you just have a two-prong plug.
That'd be the best.
So the ground goes nowhere at all. Well, I had to plug it in somewhere. We only had a two-prong outlet here. Cool.
I love it. I love it. This is my favorite auction for ages. Right. I want this thing.
Glad I didn't skip it.
You can buy it.
No, I might buy it. I'll stick it on my laptop.
Mm-hmm.
I might stick it in front of my camera.
So I think we've made it through all of my many, many auctions. And we have, I don't know, it's what, it. Like 3 hours in now or something like that? I don't know. but we are at the point of closing discussions and things to add.
Well, you've got some stuff you're talking about television, so I will mention that today I had some time on my hands and I watched the first two episodes of Daybreak on Netflix.
Uh-huh.
And I'm digging it. I'm surprised at how much I'm digging it. It's like Ferris Bueller in the apocalypse.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That sounds cool.
Yeah.
I think
I should go for that.
That was one of the ones that I was thinking about watching.
I thought I'd hate it. I saw the trailer and I was like, oh, I'm going to hate this. And I kind of want to hate it, and I might end up hating it. But for now, weirdly, it won me over and for two episodes. Surprise.
Cool.
Yep. So, recommended, kind of maybe tentatively.
Cool. I have some stuff that I want to show you guys that I talked about before when StreamYard wasn't working. This is this cool book that I bought, the Atari Visual History. It's a big, fat book. And the pages, every dual page is like this, where you have like a...
And for those of you listening at home, the pages are in color.
Yeah.
The pages are in color, and they are many, and it's a big fat book, and it's great.
That
and
is just, a big fat book. Holy moly.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know the, let's see, the numbering. 400 plus pages.
Nice.
And it's amazing. It's just all full of color and joy and beautiful things.
It's amazing like how people game. Just believe that, right? You looked at the end, and you saw a number above 400. You assume they're all numbered.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Sure. They're not skipped. I believe it.
It could be 250 pages, and they said, but the last three are numbers 400.
No, look at that. And also, I got this as a part of this Kickstarter. I got the Atari 400 keyboard-looking mouse mat, which is mouse pad.
You mentioned it before, right?
I'm very happy. Weirdly, though, I don't even use a mouse normally at home because I got this Apple trackpad, but someday I'll pull out a mouse, and I'll use this mouse pad because it's great.
You could put your hands on that and... If you weren't looking carefully, you might think that's an actual 400.
Yeah.
It has all the tactile feel of the real 400.
I just lay this over my keyboard on my laptop. It's a little bit too narrow.
And just press spongy keys.
Yeah, it might actually
Otherwise,
be better.
In my other closing notes here, I recently bought off of eBay an Atari 600 XL, which was one of the models that came out within about 83, 84. It was the lesser one that only had 16K of RAM.
Okay, so what's that? I know the 800, I know the 400. The 600 is between them. Then there was the 800 XL. So what makes a 600?
Okay, so they came out with 400.
What is this?
their numbering makes no sense. So the 400 and 800 are one thing. Those came out in 79. And then the 600 XL and 800 XL came out in 83 or 84. Just before them was the 1200 XL. So basically this is all kind of like they were moving towards making cheaper and cheaper versions of the same thing, like cheaper to manufacture. So the 600.
They're all like Atari 8-bits? Like
yeah, they're all
like
Atari 8-bits.
Okay.
Yeah. And then later, even later, they had the 65XE and the 130XE, which are all just, and those are a bit better, but still just like they're moving towards cheaper components, basically.
Okay.
So the 600XL only has 16K of RAM. It's basically like, it's like the Atari 400, but with a keyboard that's decent. So anyway, my plan, though, is to upgrade this. So I've ordered a 64K upgrade, which is brings it to its maximum natural capacity. Plus this thing called the ultimate 1 megabyte upgrade.
Ooh.
1 megabyte of RAM.
That's too much RAM.
Holy crap.
Okay, I have a question for you then. So do you have that one because for you, when it comes to Atari 8-bits, like the 600XL, that's the one? That's the one you want? That's the one for you? Or just because you have a bunch of them? Or like why pick this one?
Well, I actually don't have a bunch. So the only one I have before this is the 130XE, which is one that I had when I was a teenager also. So I mean, it's not the same one. I sold that years ago and bought a new one, I bought another one. But so my thinking is I wanted to have a machine that I could like try out testing some of the modern upgrades that are available, but I didn't want to start applying the modern upgrades to my only Atari 8-bit and risk screwing it up.
Right.
So I figured I'd rather buy another machine. And the nice thing about the 600XL is it's a quite small footprint. It's like it's the smallest desktop footprint of any of the Atari 8-bits. In fact, I remember at one point towards the end of their actual saleable life, a friend of mine was able to buy one dirt cheap, brand new from Kmart because it was marked as being an Atari keyboard. It's not much bigger than like an IBM Model M in terms of like the depth and width of it. It's certainly not as wide as that, but like it's not a very deep computer and it's not that thick. So someone's like, oh, this is a keyboard. We can sell this for $10.
Very nice.
So it's a small machine, but can be upgradable just like all the rest of them can. So before you stop, I want to demonstrate one bad feature of the Atari 130XE by holding over to the microphone.
Yep. Nice.
Listen. It's creaky.
Huh.
What?
It's settling.
It's unsettling.
And I think that by contrast, I noticed when I first got this, picked it up, it's like, doesn't creak. I can squeeze it and nothing happens. There's no sound.
It's squeezable or not squeezable.
No, it doesn't move. It's actually like a solid thing instead of a weird creaky thing.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazingly low bar for the Atari people.
I guess if you grew up with a creaky computer.
Yeah.
That's right. I had the creaky one. Because when the 130XC came out, that was like the ultimate thing because it had 128K of RAM. It's like, oh my god! But then it was built so cheaply that it just didn't. It always felt terrible and cheap, and the keyboard was mushy and just.
So if somebody was to pick up a single Atari 8-bit, they had to pick what is the one you think of as the quote unquote best.
If you want to pick up one that you don't want to upgrade and mess with, and just like use it as it is for playing available software and stuff. I would say the 800XL for most.
Even though it's kind of ugly?
I don't think it is that ugly. I kind of like the XL series, actually. I kind of like all of them.
A look of disapproval comes over the screen yard.
For those of you listening at home, I am shaking my head.
So now that I have the 600XL in my hands, and I never actually had an XL model, I actually kind of like it. Compared to what came later, it's actually very solid and very sort of, it feels like a sturdy computer. The keyboard is nice. Like the 130XC that came later has a very, very mushy keyboard. Like when you press it, you can feel, oh, I'm pressing down on a piece of sponge. Like there's just, it's really not very, very unpleasant. Whereas this has a nice feel to it. And I don't know. I have high hopes. And this one is very, very yellow. So this summer, if there is some sunlight in Sweden, I am going to try and retrobite this thing.
Cool.
And I'll let you all know how it goes.
Nice. I will say I do like the XL series, like the 800 and the 600, whatever. I do like, I'm not a huge fan of the look of those, the industrial design, but I do like them better than like the 130XE or whatever that came later with this. Because they had those slanted buttons and they just trigger me.
Yes, I agree.
Like those slanted buttons.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I actually prefer this industrial design. And see, Paul's showing a picture of the 800XL.
I love the original 800 so much.
Yeah.
The industrial is one of my favorite looking computers of all time. I adore it so much. It is so beautiful. I think I just compare all Ataris to that thing.
I guess, to your question about what is the one computer you should get, it's kind of a toss up between those two. 800 and 800XL. Not that one. So the 800 and 800XL are both quite good, but I think the 800XL is a lot easier to get a hold of. I think there are a lot more of them out there.
It's got to weigh less too. The original 800 is like 9,000 pounds.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, I think that would be one of my considerations too. Is just if I was going to get just one, it would be nice to have one that you could put on a shelf without worrying about the shelf.
Right.
Right. The game system is kind of.
I don't even understand the game system. The Atari game system, I've never understood. Like, is it just games? It's like I don't even know what that is. It's got those weird candy color buttons in the front of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what Paul is showing is the XE game system, which is another Atari 8-bit computer, but this one was designed to have a detached keyboard. And it has weird pastel buttons that represent the special buttons on all the Ataris, the reset, option, select, start. So it's the same buttons, it's just like...
But is that a slot in the top of it, like for a cartridge, or is it just a hole?
It has a diagonal cartridge slot on the top. It's a very weird... It's a weird thing. And I've actually never even seen one in person, I don't think. Mm. They're pretty unusual.
Yeah,
they're pretty unusual.
They came with like a light gun or something like
that. Yeah, they came with a light gun and with a detached keyboard with a cable, which is really that's the only Atari 8-bit that had that. So
okay.
And I was going to show you guys, so this is I'm taking advantage that I have StreamYard. This is my 130XE that I've had for a few.
See, those slanted keys.
I know, the slanted keys, I don't
the
like them either.
The slanted keys, why the slanted keys?
So this is the 600XL.
Yeah, the 600 does look a lot nicer.
Yeah,
other than yellowing.
Yeah. Right, the yellowing is pretty bad, but it's nowhere near as deep on the desk. The height is about the same, I would say. But like, I quite like the form factor of this, that
it's got a little bit Commodore 64-ness to it. I don't say that as a compliment.
I think that's just because of the yellow. I think if you saw
I think of those as being a very earth tone computer, so they didn't come that yellow to start with. I guess all the ones I've seen are very earth tony.
These were like nearly white. These were nearly gleaming white when they
The ones I've seen are not. I think of them. I thought that was supposed to be that color.
No. They were white. This was essentially a white and dark brown design. So
okay.
Anyway, that's that.
And my high school colors were orange and brown, so I cannot judge. Orange and brown. Come on, A.Y. Jackson, what were you thinking?
All right.
Go Jaguars.
So
Paul, what do you got?
The notes that I have. I did mention a bunch of TV shows, but actually if we're speaking of orange and brown, I will mention that I got an Atrona attaché, and it's really cool. I think I really like what it looks like.
I like the colors a lot.
Yeah.
I kind of like the colors. I will admit it's got orange and brown going to it. Yeah.
it's pretty small.
I don't understand it though. I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. It looks like one of those ones, like for those listening at home, of the Osborne type, where you got the box and the handle that flips down to as a prop, and then you've got a keyboard that I thought was supposed to act as a cover over the front. But the keyboard's ratio, like the dimensions, don't look the same as the front of the computer.
Oh, it does. That's the keyboard. It's a top-down view, but
wow, the photo makes it look distinctly looks narrow. Like in the photo we're looking at right now, that keyboard does not look as wide as the computer.
True.
That's because it's perspective, but like
you can see cameras,
you can see the hinges, right? Like the
look at the handle, Carrington.
Look directly at the handle.
Well, you see the sides of the handle going down.
So how tall is this thing that you've got like a perspective slant? You go down to like a 6 mile high computer. Anyway, it's very weird.
But you can see like where the little hooks are, right?
Yes. Okay.
But anyway, I like it. I think it's pretty cool. I got it for not very much. I don't remember how much now, but it was cheaper than usual.
What does one do with a computer like this?
I think this actually is a really pretty capable CPM machine. It's small. It has a fairly large screen and, you know, nice disk drives and stuff. And so what I was hoping to do with it is make it be, like, to the extent that I ever need to do something in CPM, then make this one be the thing that I do it in. You know, like I could have this near my desk or whatever for those CPM emergencies. But unfortunately, it doesn't quite work yet. So it has a composite out, so you can actually connect it to an external screen. And I tried that, and I tried to start it up, and it does sound like it's trying to boot. But the internal screen usually doesn't come on, and sometimes I've had it come on a couple of times and just show sort of garbage. It shows garbage on the external screen, and the garbage that was on the internal screen when it was on looked the same. Like, you know,
so that's good.
I guess, you know, it's consistent.
Matching garbage.
Yeah. But so I think, you know, there's something sort of, I don't know what direction stream that is. Downstream, I think. There's something upstream. I don't know. Upstream, maybe. Anyway, there's something that I need to fix, like RAM or something, that is affecting both ways of doing video out.
Mm.
So even though it does seem to be doing something, like, you know, the fact that the disk does sound like it's trying to boot suggests. Oh, and the other thing too, I took a photo of the back of it to sort of show off a thing that is not obvious, but it has an upgrade, which means that it has a Z80 computer, but it also has an 8088 in it.
Oh, that's neat.
So it can run, you know, it can run MS-DOS stuff slowly. But
okay.
So
that's cool.
Yeah. Anyway, I think I was pretty pleased about that.
Can you show the keyboard again? Because I want to say, I think I recognize the color scheme also.
Yeah. It's pretty similar. Yeah.
It's very similar to the Atari 400 keyboard colors, actually. There you go.
Yeah. But these,
no wonder
these
I like it so much.
You're using the phrase similar to the Atari 400 keyboard in a positive sense, and my brain is having difficulty wrapping around it.
No, I do like the color scheme on that. Even if it is.
Color scheme, sure. Yeah.
Yes. But that's all we're talking about.
Okay, the other things that I had put in there was just, you know, all the TV, you know, that the Expanse just started, and I think we'd mentioned that before.
Yay for the Expanse.
I think I've watched one of the 10 episodes, but, and I've also been sort of, for some reason, I've been kind of like on a space kick, so I've also been watching For All Mankind, which is something that premiered on Apple TV.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty interesting. There's, you know, old tech in that. There's a lot of the, what do you call it, Mission Control, you know, at NASA. It's sort of this alternate history where Russia beats the U.S. to the moon by like a month or something like that. And, you know, like all of the repercussions that follow from that, basically.
Yep.
Interesting.
It's interesting. I dig it. I'm kind of digging the Apple TV Plus shows. I didn't think I would.
Mm-hmm.
But I think of all of them, the one C, the blind people, that was okay, but I like For All Mankind, I think, the best.
Yeah, and I have had limited time. It's not like, yeah, I've been watching TV instead of editing. I've been squeezing a little bit.
I don't even have
TV.
A television, so I'm watching these things on my iPad. Yeah. Stream little tiny windows.
Nice. What else? Oh, the Goldbergs continues to have old tech in it. So, I mean, occasionally I am reminded that there's a Mac Plus or something like that in the dorm room for writing papers on. And
right.
So, anyway, that's about it. We just finished a semester, so now I'll have time to edit. As we're, as, you know, like, as I'm saying this, nobody has heard the previous episode because it's still sitting on my hard drive, and we didn't even stream that one, so like that one is really just a secret for everybody to wait for.
It's a little secret, but probably not that much of a surprise though.
No,
go look at the numbers.
Yeah, so largely the same kind of thing over and over again, misinformation at various levels.
That's what we do.
Yeah, that's right. Anything else?
Nope. I don't think so. Good.
Okay. So then that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. We will not be starting a Yahoo group. You can follow RCR on Twitter.
Let's do it!
At rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast or send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at a link that we'll provide in the show notes. And please write a review on iTunes, or don't, or whatever. And until next time,
Retro Compute!
Find my way back to us.